information about that, but we wanted to let you know that that will be happening because sometimes there's a question about what our schedule will be. I'm going to start out with the story this morning. I want to tell you about Lawn Chair Larry. Lawn Chair Larry. Larry Walters was a man who decided one July afternoon in 1982 that he wanted to do something. And so he went down to his local Army surplus store and bought 42, I think, weather balloons and a tank of helium and had some friends help him fill those balloons with helium and tie them to one of those, you probably know this if you're about my generation, kind of those aluminum with woven lawn chairs, you know, like different colors. It's probably like lime green and yellow or something, popular in 1982. He was a truck driver in Long Beach, California, and so he decided that he wanted to fly. And so he got his friends, helped him tie these to the lawn chair, and he grabbed his provisions for his trip, which included a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, a six-pack of beer, and a handheld pellet gun so that he could help himself get down eventually. That's it. That's all he took. He got on the chair, and his friends cut him loose, and he launched like an elevator up to 15 or 16,000 feet. Immediately. It wasn't a slow ascent. You know, kind of like hot air balloons, if you've seen that before. Like, they slowly make that. This was like, woo, right up there. On July 2nd, a Delta and TWA airline pilot reported to ground control that they saw an unidentified flying object that appeared to be a man in a lawn chair. And it was Lawn Chair Larry. Unfortunately, he was a little bewildered by how fast he went up, as you and I might be as well, and he dropped his pellet gun. That's a bummer. Larry, man, at least you got a peanut butter and jelly and a six-pack. Well, eventually, Lawn Chair Larry ended up making his way down. He got hung up in some power lines, had to get rescued by a helicopter. He was not injured. However, you can imagine that people had some questions for him when he hit the ground. One of his replies, I like this, was this: well, if the FAA had been around when the Wright brothers were testing their aircraft, they never would have got off the ground either. I like that one. When he was interviewed asking to explain his exploits, here is the quote I want you to walk away with. He said this, he said, well, I've been dreaming of doing something like this for 20 years. Actually, that picture, the black and white one is actually Lawn Chair Larry. The color one is another person who has imitated Lawn Chair Larry. They call it cluster ballooning. Don't do it. You'll get in trouble. And you might not live. But here's what he said. He said, I've been dreaming of doing this for 20 years, of going up to the clear blue sky. And here's the quote. You can't just sit there. You've got to do something. I actually like that quote. You can't just sit there. You've got to do something. We're going to spend 2 weeks here. This is kind of like a short bridge series. We're going to start a new series on Easter Sunday called The Shocking Claims of Jesus. We'll be looking at the Gospel of Mark and some of the shocking claims. They were shocking when Jesus made them in the Gospel of Mark, and they're still shocking today. But between now and then, we're going to look at 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 7 through 11 in a couple of messages, part 1 and part 2, called Make a Difference. You can't just sit there. I want to tell you that God didn't create you or I or any other person to just sit there. In Genesis 1:28, and I'm going to read this passage in the Message translation. I think I got two translations to put up on the slide. Familiar passage. God had just made all of creation. He had made people, and then God did this. He blessed Adam and Eve, the two first people, and he said this. In the Message translation, I like this. It says, prosper, reproduce, fill the earth, take charge, and then be responsible for a whole bunch of things that I won't finish the verse. So what God did is he made this whole entire amazing universe, including the earth, and he said to the first two people who he made in his image, which is recorded in Genesis 1 a little bit earlier, made in the image of God, he said, now look, I made this amazing place. Now I want you to use your leadership, your talent, your skill, your ability, your passion, your heart to make it flourish, to cause it to take off, to improve on even what I've allowed, I've made, and all these raw materials to make something great. And friends, I want to tell you this morning that God created you, every person that he's ever created, he has created to contribute to the flourishing of what he has created. That's a part of why he created people, that we would contribute to the flourishing on this planet. So that's my sermon in a sentence. Should be easy to remember. God has created you to make a difference. Every person, he's created every person to make a difference in the flourishing on this planet. So let's, I'm going to read 1 Peter 4, verses 7, 8, and 9 is what we're going to cover this morning. We'll cover 10 and 11 next week. Here's 1 Peter 7, 4, verse 7. The end of all things is near. Therefore, be alert and sober-minded for prayer. Above all, maintain constant love for one another, since love covers a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without complaining. That's our section this morning. We'll read the next couple of verses next week. So I want to start with the first phrase, 1 Peter 4:7. The end of all things is near. The end of all things, this was written 2,000 years ago. If this is true, the end of all things has been near for over 2,000 years. So was Peter, who was a witness of Jesus, wrong because it hasn't happened yet? If you think the end of all things is near today, are you right or are you wrong because it hasn't happened yet? Do you think it's going to happen in your lifetime, your kids, your grandkids, your great-grandkids? Peter was a witness to Jesus' life. He walked with him for 3 years, literally walked around with him for 3 years. He was witness to Jesus' death. He saw Jesus resurrected. Surprisingly, shockingly, he was alive, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. And he was also a witness when Jesus exited the planet and he literally ascended. We don't know exactly what that looked like, but he ascended and disappeared into the sky, into heaven. And the angel said, "What are you doing here?" This is recorded in Acts chapter 1. And while Jesus was on the planet, Peter also witnessed Jesus himself talking about that he was going to come back. The return of the Son of Man was referenced multiple times by Jesus himself. So when Peter said the end of all things was near, was he confused? Was he right? Was he wrong? Should this be in the Bible? First of all, I want to say this morning about making a difference, is that God has created you to make a difference through setting priorities, which is what David talked about a little bit, some of his priorities. So here's the question. This is how you can figure out what your most essential and important priorities are. How am I supposed to live in the light of the fact that Jesus is going to come back one day? Whether it's in my lifetime, whether it's in my kid's lifetime or my grandkid's lifetime, how I live now, how Peter lived now, how he was instructing the Christians who were undergoing pretty severe persecution, and then when he wrote this letter to them, how they lived their lives in light of the fact that the end is coming. I ran across this quote this week. I wasn't intentionally searching out quotes like this. Sometimes they just come across your path. This is an author, Greg McKeown, of a book called Essentialism. I probably will read it because I like those kind of like books like Essentialism and Minimalism. I don't know what the difference is yet. That might be the same. They might be different. They're kind of popular in certain circles. Here's his quote. I think this is great. If you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. And that, my friends, is truth. If you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. Life might, circumstances might, your boss might, your neighbors might, your kids' activities might, whatever it is. If you don't set priorities for yourself, someone else will. And then he said this, and I think this is really helpful to help us figure out what are our most important priorities. I will be repeating this frequently, probably, if you find me in conversations with you, this essence will probably come out of my mouth. He says this, it is difficult to overstate the unimportance of practically everything. When you think about what you spend your time doing, what your life is doing, it's difficult to overstate the unimportance of practically everything in comparison to the most essential things, is what he's really talking about. Your most essential priorities, it's difficult to overstate the unimportance of practically everything else. Thankfully, we have a Savior, Jesus, who while he was on the planet, someone thought, let's ask him. Jesus, what's most important? It's recorded in several places in the Gospels. Matthew 22 is one of them. And he said, the most important command is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. That's a really good guide about figuring out what your priorities, where you start with setting your priorities, is what Jesus said was most important. So how will I live? This is me speaking in the first person. How will I live so that my kids or my grandkids or my great-grandkids or myself is prepared for the end of all things? Here's what I think my first priority, maybe my first assignment from God is to make sure that I invest in my love relationship with him. Because that's what Jesus said is most important. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And let me tell you this. If this is essential for me, you should be able to open my Google Calendar app. Now, I might not put it in there. I actually do put it in there now. But you should be able to look at my Google Calendar app and tell if that's actually essential. Or if I don't put it in my app, you should be able to see my thoughts. You should be able to see my actions. You should be able to see the habits of my life to see, is loving God a priority in my life? So the next part of that, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, is this, to love your neighbor as yourself. That's pretty broad. But for me personally, and probably for you, I know for you personally, God has given you some neighbors that he expects you to love particularly well in a way that he expects no one else to love. For me, that starts with my wife. I'm married. And no one else is called to love and care for and cherish Andrea like I am. And so my next assignment, my first human assignment, you could say my first neighbor assignment, is to love her well. And if that's really essential, again, you should be able to look at my Google Calendar, my thought life, my habits, my conversations. If you could read my mind, you could see what's going on in my head. My life, and say, is that reflected in how I live? You should be able to see it in me, and if that's your priority, I should be able to see it in you, right? So my second human assignment, my next human assignments, my next closest neighbors, if you will, that God has given me personally to love in a way that he's given nobody else are my kids. Again, you should look in my Google Calendar, see in my thoughts if you could read them, look at my life, my habits, and my behaviors to see is that reflected in how I respond to God's priorities. And you know what? Everything else is what's next. And I actually think that if we read the scriptures faithfully, if we do those well, if God has given you some, like if you're married, if you have kids, that's not the end of your priorities. But if you figure out how to do those really well, your ability to do the other priorities God gives you, the other parts of his assignments, and believe me, he gives you other ones. We're going to talk about it a little bit this week and a lot more next week, that you'll be able actually to, out of the love you have for God, out of the love that you're able to express and experience to your closest neighbors, you will be empowered to do the rest of your assignment better than you could if you get the priorities mixed up. So what about helping people to find and follow Jesus? That's a motto of ours here at Cottonwood. We want to try to help people find and follow Jesus. Well, that is reflected in some of those. I want to sure help my kids and my wife find and follow and cultivate a deep relationship with Jesus. But my ability to do that with everybody else comes out of my ability to do it in my home first. I believe that. I believe that. And I also believe this. In Ephesians, when Paul talks about marriage, Ephesians chapter 5. Actually, I won't turn to it. I'll just tell you. He actually says this. Marriage is actually a sign of the gospel. And how you live out with your wife, it actually displays what the gospel is like. It's a picture of how Christ loves the church. And so figuring out how to do that well actually displays for the world who's watching how Jesus loves us. So here's one little way that I'm trying to do that. You know how easy it is? I appreciated Dave sharing some of the priority changes for him as he's gotten older. Here's such a priority change for me. I've just been trying to say yes when my youngest daughter asked me to play. Because guess what? She has a really short attention span. And saying yes is actually not as big of an ask, as I sometimes make it in my mind, like I'm in the middle of doing this thing or I'm in the middle of doing this thing, to try to say yes. Like this just happened the other day. Dad, will you come play store with me? Yes, I came over, I played store, I sat down, I pretend to buy things, and she brought me, I don't remember what it was, ice cream or donuts or something. It's always sweets, because that's what kids like to sell, for pretend. And usually, I should say. And then like 3 minutes later, she was playing with her other sister or sisters, I can't remember, and I was just sitting there kind of like, not really sure if I was involved, and just kind of got up and went back to what I was doing. But what I said, by saying yes, and I don't, and believe me, I've said no or not right now or in a little bit or later way more times than I've said yes. That's why I'm trying to change it. Because it reflects a little bit of like, I'm going to invest in saying yes because that means something to her. Does anybody, some of you might know who Luis Palau was. He died a few years ago. He was a very famous evangelist. He was a contemporary of Billy Graham. Luis Palau traveled the world, I think, close to 100, maybe more countries. It's estimated that he shared the gospel with over 1 billion people. And I heard a story recently of somebody who's a family friend of the Palau family, and so they were invited to go to sort of like the friends and family funeral for Luis Palau. I think he died 3 or 4 years ago. And what was this gentleman was amazed by was that at this family and friend funeral, where Luis Palau, the famous evangelist who shared the gospel with 1 billion people, not one word during the whole time they were together with friends and family was spoken about his ministry. Not one thing. All that was shared about was how he loved his wife well. He was a really good dad. He was a great grandpa. He was a faithful friend. Nothing about the fact that he probably shared the gospel as much as almost anybody else who's ever lived. You know, maybe Billy Graham has shared with more. Amazing. I think what that speaks, what it spoke to me is that when you're gone, the people who God has asked you to care for most specifically, making sure you care for them most specifically is really what will be most important. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm glad that because he did that well, he was empowered to go and share the gospel with over 1 billion people. And I'm sure there will be many people who will be thankful that Luis was faithful to his call, God's call in their life, that he went out and preached and didn't just stay home the whole time. But I think they're connected. I don't think they're disconnected. So priorities. I want to give you one more note, by the way. In 1 Peter 4:4, which I don't think will be on the screen, it's just previous to this, Peter's giving a, he says this, he says, people will be surprised that you don't join them in the same flood of wild living and they slander you. I'm just going to create this application is that when you decide to make your priorities focused on Christ and what God would call you to, don't be surprised when the culture around you thinks you're weird or strange. Or maybe, because here's what can happen, why they might slander you in this context is they might actually feel bad that their priorities are what they are when they understand what your priorities, what they are. So the difference between the two, it's not that you're necessarily judging, but they feel that way in some sense. Maybe it's the conscience, maybe it's the Holy Spirit, I don't know, because they're living in a different way than you are living. I'm just telling you, if you want to try to figure out how to live with God's priorities with the end in mind, that might happen. Don't be surprised at that. Okay, God has created you to make a difference. We have more to cover than just the first phrase of verse 7. The end of all things is near. The sermon in a sentence to remind you again, God has created you to make a difference. My contention is that you can't make the difference God has created you to make unless you figure out your priorities right first. That's important. We're going to talk about, by the way, all the rest of the things. I spent a lot of time on like the first couple priorities. There'll be other priorities as well as we go along. Okay, the end of all things is near. Therefore, verse 7 says, be alert and sober-minded for prayer. Be alert and sober-minded for prayer. We could talk about being alert and we could talk about being sober-minded, but what I want to focus on is the reason you are to be alert and sober-minded is prayer. Prayer, my friends, makes a difference. You and I can make a difference through prayer. Being alert to that. So recently, our church is connected with several other churches in the region, church in Warren that we helped plant years ago, in Fargo, and then other churches in the cities and in Wisconsin. And I have friends who are pastors of those churches, and we connect at various times. But we decided, hey, why don't we try to do a monthly prayer Zoom meeting? And I'll be honest, as a pastor, I was not that excited. Prayer meetings are also not that exciting to me at times. However, I was challenged by my friend Brent, who led the meeting and said we should really do this, by saying, you know what? The word on the street is that God actually answers prayer. He's tongue-in-cheek, and it's true. And I needed that little kick in the pants, like, okay. And really, it's not that I'm not excited about prayer, but you know what I'm not excited about? I'm not excited about adjusting my routine, because this was going to be in the morning, on a morning when I had other things that I normally like to do, and I didn't want to have to change. Maybe selfishness? Just don't want to change? We've done it once. We're about to do it another time. I'm glad that we're doing it. I need to do it. It's caused me to suggest maybe we should spend time as a leadership team, this conversation anyways, to spend time praying. So we've spent a little more time recently praying for specific needs for people in our church when we meet together once a month. I love that I occasionally, and this happens when I'm least expecting it, I will be in the church at a random time of day, and I will bump into a couple of you who are gathered together here or there and praying in one of these rooms. Prayer really is a way to make a difference. The reason why we're to be alert and sober-minded is that we're actually engaged in a spiritual battle. And the Bible describes prayer, not preaching, not teaching, not lots of the other gifts, but prayer as the primary weapon in that spiritual battle. And I'll just say this for me, as someone who's following Christ for a long time, it's easy for me as well to forget that prayer is that important. It really is. In helping people to find and follow Jesus, prayer is really the best place to start. Prayer is the best place to start, to pray for people. I would guess that almost every person who has ever found Jesus has had one or multiple or many people praying for them, maybe even specifically, that they would find Jesus. We're going to find out at the end of all things about some of those prayers, because some of those prayers are going to get rewarded by Jesus, because God used those prayers to bring people to him. Okay, verse 8 says this: above all, so the end of all things is near, therefore be alert, sober-minded for prayer. Above all, that's always when you see those, you want to be like, okay, what's about to happen? Above all, this is saying really, really important. Maintain constant love for one another, since love covers a multitude of sins. Above all, maintain constant love for one another, since love covers a multitude of sins. That's verse 8. We'll cover verse 9 in a minute. So pay attention. Remember, this is what Jesus said was most important. It's not surprising that Peter also said, above all, it's kind of like, more important than anything else I'm going to say, love. And why is he saying that? Because when Jesus was asked, what's most important? Jesus said, love. He's just echoing what he heard his teacher say. Love. You can make a difference through love. I'm going to break down this phrase, though. You can make a difference through love. Above all, maintain. Let's just pause on maintain. So I was driving a couple of years ago in a caravan of friends, and we were driving across Minnesota into Wisconsin. We have a conference that we've attended called Fusion over the years. And I was following one of my friends who's driving a minivan, I can't remember. But in Wisconsin and Minnesota, they use a lot more salt on their roads than we use in North Dakota, right? So it's kind of that slushy in between, like it's not snowing, but all of the spray that's coming up off the road is on your windshield. And I see this, we're driving along, and I didn't see the passenger side window go down, but I knew it was down because all of a sudden there was an arm out the window like this, with the cup in the car in front of me, and then all of a sudden I had like water flying onto my windshield because that person had like chucked a cup of water, or a bottle of water, I can't remember, onto the windshield to try to like get the windshield clean. Because why do they do that? Because they're out of windshield fluid. They didn't have windshield fluid, and they want to pull over. So every once in a while, the arm would go out, and a little bit of water would splash up. You know, when the windshield wipers splat, it kind of flies. I was probably following a little too close if I'm getting water on me from their windshield wipers. Why do you maintain your fluids, your windshield wiper fluid? Now, that's not going to affect your car too much, right? But to be honest, it can get a little dangerous if you don't have it and you're in that situation with really salty, slushy roads and your car's like got all the white streaks and the sun is out. That makes it really even nicer, right? The sun's reflecting on that white, harder to drive. Why do you make sure that you have enough oil in your car or your other fluids? Why do you make sure that your brakes, they actually put these little metal clips, if you're ever driving along and you hear this strange whistle like you would hear if you were driving my minivan right now because I need new brakes, you would know that that's a little warning sign that your brakes are getting low and you should get some new pads put on them. Why do you put new brake pads on? Lights, have you ever got pulled over for not having lights or blinkers, or is that just me and the people that live in my house that have gotten warnings for that? Why do you have to make sure that in the wintertime that you charge your battery or that your battery is new enough or that you plug it in ahead of time? Why do we do all that? Because you want your car to keep running, right? It takes a little bit of effort to maintain your car so that it runs and stays operable in the way that it's meant to stay. Above all, maintain constant love. And I'm just here to say that maintaining love takes effort. And it's actually sometimes not that fun. Like, checking your fluids isn't all that fun, right? That's why, like, I used to do it all myself, and I just drive into the little bay and they check everything and they fill it all up for me because I'm too lazy and don't really want to take the time to do it. It's fine. If you laugh, you probably are lazy too, and that's fine. We'll be lazy together. Maintain proper love. And also, here's why. It takes effort, but also the reality is that it degrades over time, right? You know, why is it that I fill my oil and then like 3 months later, it's still not full? Or it's not as clean. Well, that's how an engine works. It's not meant to do that. But in my mind, I'm kind of like, why do we have to keep doing this? That's kind of like that with love. It takes effort to maintain love. And I just want to make a comment. I'm really thankful that this morning we have online worship or church service. I think we've figured out the problems with that. If you've been frustrated at home, sorry for that. I think we figured it out. We've had the last couple of weeks. All that has worked. And I'm thankful for that because actually it's helping people to figure out and find a way to church. More people are able to like check out what I want to go there. It takes a lot of guts to walk into a building like this for the first time if you haven't been to church in a while. Like a lot of courage. Like we do it once in a while when we're somewhere else and I'm uncomfortable. And I do this for a living. It's uncomfortable, okay? And I'm glad that you can sort of get a taste of what it might be like by watching a service. Of course, you don't get a full taste, but it kind of be like, dip your toes in the water. That's really helpful. And I'm glad that when you're sick or the weather's too bad for where you are, we live out of town, that you can watch a service online. But you know what can't be replaced by online church service? Is you can't be personally engaged with other people through just an online service. Even if you attend regularly that way, if you don't figure out a way to be engaged with actual people, you're not able to like do a verse like this in 1 Peter 4:7 and 4:8, about maintain constant love. And the 56 other one another's that are in the Bible, it actually requires relational, personal engagement. It's important. The next phrase says this, since love covers a multitude of sins. Love covers a multitude of sins. And I want to just give you a couple of examples of what this is like. One of them is you just cheer on the good you see in somebody else. Love cheers on the good they see in somebody else rather than focusing on the bad. Another way of saying that, love focuses more on what's going right and less on what's going wrong. That's actually part of how I think you apply it. Love covers a multitude of sins. One of my friends, Mark, who is a retired pastor, and one of the things he does now is he lets me call him once a month, and he pastors me, and I ask him questions, and he encourages. And you know what he does most of the time? It's like 75% encouragement. Like, that's pretty much what it is. It's 75% or so encouragement. He says things like, I wish I knew what you knew at your age. You're farther down the road than I was at your age, emotionally and spiritually. I wish I was at that place. He says, the future's looking bright for you, friend. And I'm telling you, usually when he's saying that, it's not because I'm believing it. It's usually because I'm not believing it. And he wants to help me believe it. Love covers a multitude of sins. But here's what it doesn't mean also. It doesn't mean you ignore it when someone you love is straying from God's path and going down a path that you see is going to head towards destruction. Love doesn't do nothing. It's actually the opposite of love. If you see a friend or someone you care about headed in a way that's destructive, to overlook what they're doing as they stray farther and farther from the truth and never say anything when you have the relational equity to do so. I'm not saying you go out and say that to everyone you see, okay? That's a really good way to make people mad at you. But when you're close to somebody and you see that happening, love does something about it. It's called false peace when you do nothing. About someone that you care about, when you see that they're, that you're, basically what you're saying is, I will not bring healthy disruption into our relationship potentially because I value not having conflict more than I value you. That doesn't sound very loving, right? It's actually false peace. It's saying, I want a sort of peace. I don't want to introduce potential conflict. So I had another friend, John. He asked me this question. It actually stopped me in my tracks. I didn't answer it well at the time, but he just looked at me. He doesn't even remember asking me because I asked him about it. We were at late night conversation. He goes, Pat, is there anything that you need me to know about you that I don't know? It's one of those hard questions. And there was, and I didn't say it, and I regretted it, and I had to say it again later to him. But love covers a multitude of sins doesn't mean you overlook things. Actually, you care about the people you care about most and want to help them stay on the right track. The last part of this phrase is be hospitable in verse 9. Be hospitable to one another without complaining. So this is just a practical way to maintain constant love. Be hospitable. Show hospitality without complaining. You know why that's on there? Because it's never a good time. It's never a good time to have somebody come over, to show hospitality. It's never convenient. Even when you schedule it a month ahead of time because you want to make it convenient, the day comes around. Hospitality, I'm talking about hospitality. Just, you know, that's my cue for the band. A practical way to show and deepen and develop love within our church is to show hospitality in your relationships. Share a meal. Invite somebody over. You know what? Mark and John and others who've been faithful friends to me, part of why we're that kind of friend is because we've showed hospitality to each other over the years. That's how you can do it. Hospitality is also a bridge you can take to like reach somebody and develop another friendship that you might be able to help that person find Jesus or follow Jesus as well. It can be a verse that, this verse has challenged me to expand our circles. You know what? Has this happened to you, by the way? It's happened to me that the last few years was easy. Like the shutdown happened and your circles had to be small. It was easy for them to stay small, wasn't it? It's been kind of hard to like push ourselves to expand our circles a little bit more. Show hospitality is one way to do it, is just to have someone over for a meal or coffee or play beanbags or whatever else you like to do. It's never convenient to do it. Okay, so God has made you and I to make a difference. He's created you to make a difference. He's created me to make a difference. One of the ways is figuring out our priorities. Another way is to pray. It really does make a difference. Another way is through love. Hospitality would be one example of a practical way to do that. Next week, we're going to talk about some of the ways that God has given each of us unique abilities, gifts, and insights to make a difference. So I hope that you'll come back and join us for that. But I want to leave with a question. How does God want you to make a difference? Have you asked that of him? How does he want you to make a difference? And is there any adjustments that he would have you make? Is there anything he would want you to do? Just shift a little bit. By the way, I think the best changes are not overhauls. It takes a long time to overhaul an engine. It doesn't take that much time to just say, every 3 months, I'm going to go through Valvoline. That's a lot easier to do. Is there maybe just a little shift that God would want you to make that would help you to make the difference he's designed you to make? That's my prayer this morning. Let's stand, and we'll pray together and sing this song. Lord, thank you for creating us to do something significant. You did not create us to just sit there. You didn't create us to be like a tree or even like one of the animals that would sort of just do things by instincts. You wanted us to participate. You created us in your image. When you made this amazing place, you said, I'm going to make each person after these first two to also be created in a unique way to contribute to the flourishing of what I prepared for them to enjoy. Help us, Lord, to do that well. Help us to figure out how to arrange our priorities so that they're in line with what you would want. Help us to put prayer as a priority, Lord, that it does really make a difference, and to figure out how to maintain love, because that also makes a difference. Thank you, Jesus, for creating us this way. Thank you for inviting us into this life, not to just sit and watch, but participate in what you're doing in this world. In your name I pray, Jesus. Amen.